Hi, hello. Welcome to Season 5 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. We talk about money, mental health, relationships, the creative process itself, and everything in between. This season specifically focuses on creativity within the realm of environmental conservation and social public art. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne. Hannah Spencer does all of our design and branding, and Lonnie Webb runs our Instagram and makes many of our visuals. Big thanks to Jeffrey Silverstein, who was a guest on our last season, for letting us use his song, Given the Light, this season's intro music. Hope you all dig it. Hey, we are getting close to wrapping up this season, which makes me sad. But good news is, the episodes live on forever. After this one, we have two more. This one is super educational, especially for those interested in agriculture, farming, or even like gardening. There's really solid tidbits on making your garden more environmentally friendly. And this conversation is with Scott Horner, who with his partner runs a small potatoes farm in Paonia, Colorado. We chat about what brought him and his family to Paonia and the benefits of traveling and moving around. Before that, the farming ecosystem in the area and how farms work together, but also how the community works together in general. We dive pretty deep into permaculture practices, a lot of the benefits of purchasing from small farmers, not just in terms of what you're putting in your body, but from a community standpoint. His journey from architecture school to farming, the role of technology in sustaining his farm and his career. And obviously, of course, we talk about the drought that was happening in 2018 as really the underlying topic of each of these conversations in this season. Yeah, we also talk about like fracking and the importance of regulation and money in general. Sweet. Of course, you can find links to small potatoes and anything else we talk about in this episode at theprocess.co. Yeah, hope y'all dig it. Cheers, y'all.
My name is Scott Horner. I'm the vegetable grower here at Small Potatoes Farm. We're in Paonia, Colorado, located on a mesa just outside of town, a beautiful mesa called Lambourne Mesa. And we farm about 2 acres of mixed vegetables. And we do it with a method that's based on the organic method, not using any chemicals or, you know, anything that would hurt the nature of the land. We do it in a way that feels good to us. And so we grow vegetables and sell them here at the farm. And we have a little market at our barn. We call it the barn market. So every weekend we harvest the produce and then sell it right here. And then throughout the week we continue to plant more stuff and harvest it and take care of it, nurture it, and make it happen each week.
How long have you been in Paonia?
I've been in Paonia 10 years.
What brought you here?
What brought me here was the possibility to grow food in Colorado. This is a pretty well-known farming community. It's a beautiful valley that's fed by all the water. There's a lot of water here that's sourced from the mountains, from the snowpack each year. And so that was a big reason to come here. And also at the time, my kids were looking, they were really little, and we were looking to transition from homeschooling as they got older to some sort of schooling, and there were some really cool alternative school options here. And so that was a really big reason as well. And then just the community of people, really like the tight-knit, small community. A lot of people here that are into the arts, very just awesome folks, you know, creative people figuring out how to make a living out here kind of in the middle of nowhere, you know, so just really, really interesting place. So for those reasons, to farm and to have our kids be a part of a school, and then to be part of such a really interesting and diverse, awesome little community.
Where did you come?
Well, before here, I was in Durango, Colorado, about 4 hours south. A much bigger town, really beautiful place as well, but quite a bit bigger. You can get lost in the shuffle there. Here, it's so much smaller that you really actually can't get lost in it. You kind of take a part in it, you know, real quickly, and people ask you to do things and so on and so forth. And before that, I was in Vermont, kind of looking for the same thing, you know, farming and a place to raise a family in a neat community of people. There's something really cool stuff going on up there as well. And then before that, in New Mexico, doing the same thing, and in the Northwest Washington State, and it goes on and on. I've been traveling around looking for the same kind of thing, and then now I'm here, and it's kind of culminating. I'm here, it seems like, for a while now, you know. And
cool.
I've been here for a while, and it seems like I continue to stay here for a while, so.
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Pennsylvania, southwestern Pennsylvania.
What sparks all the moves? Like, when do you know it's time to get up? And
well, I think because just that, as it's always like, well, this is neat and everything, but, you know, haven't seen that place over there, you know. Because I guess up until that point, I hadn't traveled as much. I didn't start traveling until I was in my, like, mid to late 20s. And so then when I got together with somebody and we started having children, we both still hadn't seen a lot of this country. And so as we had kids and we thought, oh, well, we'll settle here maybe. But then we just still both were like, well, what it's like over there, you know, like in New Mexico in the desert. And what's it like in Northwest Washington? And what's it like in Vermont? And then what's it like in the, you know, in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado? Just kind of that, like, traveling, like, gypsy blood, I guess, in me of some sort.
Yeah.
That is looking for, and I still kind of want to travel, you know, like, be fun to kind of go and live on another farm somewhere else, even in a different part of the world, even, you know, like, that's kind of a future dream of mine, is to maybe do some kind of farm stays and wherever in Europe or, you know, anywhere really, just to go and experience diverse places. And I think it's just fun when you go to travel, and maybe to move is to, like, yeah, you kind of want that freshness of being in a new place, and it's exciting, mm-hmm. you know, for a while. But then when later on, when you have kids and it's time to settle down some, you know, it's just not as easy to pick up and travel when your kids are older and they're committed to a school and their social net. Yeah. Their social world is there, and it's like, they are not excited about leaving maybe. And so, that's kind of what sparked the moves, just the fun of finding new places and being able to actually do that at the time. The family was really small, and we had a camper van, you know, and we could do that. So just, oh, we're going to move, you know, get rid of everything. And I'm glad, really glad I did it. And now it feels good to just be settled for a while. In this place, which it's a pretty fun place to be settled, you know.
Totally. I can definitely relate to that. I started traveling a lot, like, 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely bit by the bug. What has it been like kind of starting over in Paonia?
Well, you know, starting over here was pretty easy because, for one, just that there are so many awesome people here that are willing to help you or give you an opportunity to do something. And so starting over here was like, that's what it was like, you know, just like, oh, we wanted to farm, and oh, this person here had land and said, oh, I, you know, this person I'm speaking about now that I'm still on that land, you know, they were ready to not be farming because of just wanting to do other things and not being able to physically do it as much. And so I came on the spot and was like, oh, what about, you know, you taking it on? And so it's actually been pretty easy. I mean, of course, it's still a lot of work, you know. It's like you're day in and day out of, like, sticking with it and filling what you say you're going to do and sticking, you know, just building up your farm business or whatever business you take on in this community. But it's so possible here, I think, because people, you know, if they like you, of course, if you, like, fit into the place. I mean, if you're somebody who's coming here to, like, destroy the land or something, no one's going to want you to be here, right? But if you're coming here to, like, play a part that helps to, you know, make the place more fun, you know, like, if you're an artist, a musician, a farmer, somebody who's here, maybe an activist to help keep the place wild and from being developed in some negative ways. Those kind of people are really welcome here, and when you know, and it just enriches the community. And so it's been just really easy. It's pretty easy place to lock in with, you know.
Yeah. There's like a handful of farms here?
Yeah, there's a couple handful. It depends on how far you go, you know, down the valley and stuff. But there's quite a few, you know. They're not just everywhere, of course. But there are some really awesome farms here, and a lot of vegetable farms, orchards, hemp farms now. There's quite a few of those.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people raising animals of all kinds and stuff.
Do you and the other local farms work together at all?
Yeah, we do. We share, you know, we share knowledge. We get together and basically that's one of the big things is sharing knowledge, ideas, maybe some of the same resources, equipment possibly. In any way you could help your neighbor farm, you know, your friends who are farming, we all rise to that occasion.
That's mm-hmm. great.
Yeah, yeah.
What markets are you serving? Are you mostly local, or yeah, are you one of the folks that's also Aspen?
We're mostly local. I mean, we are at this point. It used to be we did use some other people to, you know, they would buy our produce and resell it, take it and to places, especially up in the Roaring Fork in the Aspen area. But now, over the years, we've gotten to where, I guess it's just that this area has changed recently in the last, say, 3-4 years quite a bit, that there are a lot more people. There's more people here, but not only that, that the people that are now here, like there's a lot of new folks here, they really want the local food, you know? And so our customer base numbers have gone up quite a bit in the last 2 years, especially, to where we now only sell right off the farm here.
Cool.
From our market.
Yeah.
And that we really like that because it keeps it more simple for us. And wholesaling is an awesome thing to do, and I've done that. But I really like just doing the retail right here direct. And there's just some advantages of it that I really like. And we really like our relationship with the community through that. And if you can, you might as well, you know,
yeah.
And that's where we're at right now. Maybe that won't always be the case. And we're a pretty small farm, and our production is fairly limited based on how much land you have, the fertility of the land, and your methods of how you produce the food, you know. And so if you have those factors have somewhat limited how much production we have or how much food we produce. So it's not like, you know, we have so much that it's extra and that we need to try to truck it somewhere else. We still, even if we had more food, we wouldn't have to sell it outside of the valley, I don't think. We would just sell it through other resellers right here, uh-huh. like the natural food store downtown and the other natural food store over there, or through other, you know, there's a bunch of different places that would just resell it right here. And we don't even, at least this year, because we have had a drought year, we have so much less that we wouldn't have been able to do that at all. And in most years now, we don't have it, even just because there's so many people coming right to us.
Uh-huh.
So it's just been perfect. We really like selling right here. We don't have to like drive it anywhere. We don't have to like drive 2 hours to a farmer's market.
Right.
You know, and that's fun for a little while, but after a while it's like, oh.
Yeah. Well, it looks insane. Not really worth the return.
Yeah. Well, it can be worth the return for sure, but it is just a lot of work, you know. It's like, yeah. And if you have back-to-back markets and it's like you're up all night Friday night getting ready for Saturday, and then you're up all night Saturday getting ready for the Sunday market, you know, after so many weeks of that in the summertime, you're like, wow, you know. And you have to hire more people, and then you have to manage people, and your business can be big and challenging if you're not up for that, it might not be what you want.
In terms of where you want your business to be, staying your lifestyle?
Yeah, for the most part, I think, yeah, it's basically there, except we want to refine it and make it better. Then, you know, we don't need to necessarily do more volume of production and selling, but we want to make it better in a few ways. One, so that if we would like to build our fertility on the farm up. Mm. We noticed this year in a drought year that our fertility was lacking because we didn't have as much water, could see where our weaknesses were. And if we would have had our fertility built up previous to this drought year, we would have done better with what little water we had.
Okay.
And other just basic kind of permaculture type methods of farming would have helped out. And so, you know, we're learning through a hard year what we need to do. But basically we're pretty happy with where we're at. We want to, you know, improve it in a way so that we have better produce. We have a better quality of life in the way that we're not working as much.
Mm.
And just so that we have our systems down so that we're not like, you know, we have more time off each week because things are more efficient. And so that's the thing. After so many years of farming, you start to see, oh, yeah, I, like, walk way over there, and then I forgot my tool, you know, whereas if I had it on my belt, I wouldn't have had to walk the way back over. Just simple things like that. You know,
yeah.
You cover a lot of ground in a day, you know, and then just different techniques on irrigation, on how you maintain the plants, so that you don't have too many weeds. You know, there are tricks to this that then after so many years, you're like, oh yeah, now I see. Now I don't have as many weeds because I learned these new tricks. These new, I've got some different tools or different skills now. Then you have less work and everything just starts, the quality of the produce goes up. Your customers appreciate it more and you just keep building that business even without like necessarily growing a whole bit, not even that much more food. Just making it better in those ways. And so that's where I'm, it's kind of part two for me now here. I've got to the place where, yeah, we have the customers, we got some of the systems in place that are making sense, and we're seeing that there's, it's a really good future for selling this produce. Now let's refine it, make it better that way.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Where are you learning these tricks?
Well, I learn a lot of it through other farmers, either whether they're local or, you know, on YouTube. You know, I mean, you can learn a lot that way. Going to conferences, you know, sometimes you, there's speakers at those conferences that are, that's oftentimes what the conference is about. It's people coming there to share what they've learned, and they've been doing it for a long time and really know what they're doing, and they can give you some insight on how to make your system work better. Yeah, and just all the way, all the knowledge that's out there, and a lot of it does come through the computer. You know, you just like, oh, how can I, you know, cultivate this product, this crop better? You plug it in. Wow, look at all these these people doing this, and like, here's how I do it, and here's how I do it, and here's how I do it. And then you can choose and pick some ideas from each one, and be like, wow, that's clever. I never thought about that, you know. And so it's amazing how simple some of it can really be.
Yeah.
You know, and some of the tools now are that are available through some of the manufacturers out there are amazing for small farms like this. That they've been just working on the new ideas because it's such a big movement. The small farm movement now for, you know, organic production, especially with farms that are an acre, half an acre, even urban farms where people make a decent living on a very small bit of land. There's these specialized tools that you can get that really make it work, you know, and then these people sell it or and teach you how to use it just, you know, even online. So,
yeah, a couple of obvious questions. One is for any listeners who might be familiar with permaculture but don't really know what it is. Can you explain that?
Yeah, permaculture is a type of, it's not even what I'd say agriculture, it's more of a way of life. So when you have an a permaculture farm or a permaculture community, it's a place where the land is being utilized in a way that is more natural. You're looking at natural systems in order to grow the food, to create the community. And you, for example, wouldn't use, you're basically looking how to work with water so that the water would be, like say it rains and it's not just gonna wash and run down the land and erode a big part of your land and leave your land really fast and go somewhere else, but rather you would have swells and pond catchments and things like that. And in those ponds, you would have fish, for example, that you could live on. And the fish produce water with fertilizer in it. And that fertilizer would be utilized on some of the crops that you grow to eat. And usually on a permaculture community farm, there are people there working it, and they live in a way that is, it's a way of living that, like they work with nature in a way, even in their daily life, in their home, in everything they do, so that instead of fighting nature and farming maybe in straight lines and doing tillage, you know, using a rototiller a lot and destroying the soil, you're doing things more where you're establishing plants like perennial things and growing things under the shade of a tree, but yet that tree maybe produces peaches for you to eat instead of using a structure where it has a synthetic shade cloth on it and then growing the vegetables inside the shade tunnel, which is all this embodied energy and metal and things like that that you've had to buy in. Well, instead, the idea would be to grow the shade. And then the tree and the vegetable living under the tree, there's going to be possibly symbiotic relationships. And then you're creating in that dynamic a place to host the birds and all these other small mammals and snakes and everything. And all that is a very... You're seeing a really rich ecosystem on a permaculture farm where everything plays its part and just enriches the whole thing. And the human beings that live on that place are going to be healthier because of those that environment. It's not devoid of life. It's not scorched earth, you know.
Right.
It's like, because the soils have been built up and not rototilled as much or worked to where they're burned out, they're richer and they're more drought tolerant, resilient in the drought years, and it's more likely to thrive.
Yeah.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And there, you know, I haven't studied permaculture. I've never gone to any of the courses or anything, but I've read about it and have started to utilize and bring it onto this farm. But it's all about the idea of taking care of each other too on the place. Whereas the humans on the land work together and feed each other and take care of each other and build the straw bales or the whatever type of natural buildings on the land together. It's community, you know, and the that's a big part of the basis. It's about people getting along and not being too individual or working against each other and sharing things and eating meals together and that kind of thing. So it's a really big, comprehensive kind of program there on a permaculture farm.
Totally. Carolina elsewhere and I had a big long conversation the other day about how community is also a buzzword right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
People use it in reference to like social media and stuff like that, but it's like not, I think what you're speaking to is like true community.
Yeah, it's more of a community. It would be intimate in some ways in the way of like where, yeah, you like are working together and eat and sharing meals together.
Yeah.
And it's a heartfelt type of relationship, you know, where you feed each other and take turns doing the jobs, and when it's time to build somebody's house, you get together and build that house, you know.
Yeah.
So it's pretty neat. I think we're really lacking that in America, you know, and like politically it's become a very tumult, you know, just a very ugly scene. And to start at the level of the very small local and on the farms, especially building community where we are friends and help each other instead of seeing how we can take advantage of somebody,
yeah,
you know, financially or in any way, and just to start opening our hearts, you know, and changing the way we really live, you know. And so permaculture, it's a very deep thing that it really is. It's something that starts to change. It's there to change the way we think, you know, the old paradigm, you know, throw it away.
Yeah.
And let's be like village, you know,
yeah.
Village people.
Totally. I have a little bit of background in community building, and usually the, like, what brings community together is a shared interest. And
mm-hmm.
it sounds like beyond food and farming, it's very much about like the earth and
mm-hmm.
protecting it and
yeah.
showing appreciation for it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. An even more obvious question. What you mentioned, the movement towards supporting your average consumer, maybe supporting more small farms.
Mm-hmm.
Small farms are kind of like starting to have their day again.
Yeah.
What, from your perspective, has sparked that?
Well, I think there's probably a few things in that. I think some people are they're saying, well, here especially in this community, a lot of people are supporting the small farms more and more and more is because they want to see the local economy thrive. They want to see the small little businesses, the farms and other types of business here thrive, because they know that if we don't have a thriving economic community, then the place could dissolve in some ways, or it just becomes kind of like a community where people kind of hide out. If you have enough money, then you can live there and you just order everything on from online, all your food and whatever, and you just don't have neighbors and you live in your fenced and tightened, you know, high security place. The people here don't want that. They want like a rich community. They want people that we can all like thrive together. And if customers come here and buy my food, then I generate I generate income. Then I spend it locally too.
Right.
You know, and oftentimes I'll spend it at that very bit. You know, another business that a customer of mine's business, and it's just this back and forth. You know, and so that's a big driver here, specifically here. I think other people do it for health reasons too. They want to have the freshest vegetables that haven't been picked weeks ago, you know, or however long ago, and trucked across the country, and they doubt the quality of it in a lot of ways. Like, well, first of all, it's not that fresh, and maybe, who knows, maybe it does have some weird stuff on it, you know, even if it says it's certified organic, you don't maybe know, you know.
I've heard that doesn't mean very much.
Yeah, nowadays, yeah, you don't, there's some issues around that, you know, and just the bigger the farms your food comes from, maybe it's not that safe. Yeah. It could be contaminated, polluted, you know, with bad water or whatever, where it was produced. I'm not saying that that's, you know, it's just, there's a possibility of that. And we have seen that there are certain people, you know, illnesses that have been traced back to very large farms, you know, and they just bad practice. So that's another reason. The other reasons for here, at least, why people are coming around and really supporting the farms, I think, is, you know, again, they just really want to see this community succeed. So economically, you know, they want to have, they want to spend their money, and so that it's, the area is enriched. I think, too, if people like you, you know, they want to buy your food, too. So if they like the farmer, you know, and like what the farmer's doing, like, again, too, here, I think people like what we're doing. It's not just that they like us personally, but they really like what we're doing. We're looking to beautify the area as well. Like, and we're looking to, besides it being just beautiful, what comes with that kind of beauty, at least my idea of beauty, is an ecosystem that's really thriving naturally. So you would have, you know, by the way we farm here, we really work hard at not destroying the nature. And instead, we encourage nature. We're very careful, like, oh, there's a praying mantis. Be careful. You don't step on that. Or there's a toad. Oh, my goodness. Wow, we love toads, you know. Yeah. Oh, look at all the birds. Wow, we love the birds. And we, each year, we say, oh, isn't it seem like there's more birds here every year? Because I think that this farm is getting richer with its life force because of the way we farm it, that you therefore have, like, certain insects that can succeed, and some of those are our pests on our vegetables, you know, and we deal with that too, but we, you know, we take losses here and there, but it's worth it, because what it seems to do is it seems to bring in the birds and other animals that really enrich the environment. When you hear birds singing in the mornings, it's just like, you kind of say to yourself, that's why we do this. Yeah. Partly, you know, a big part of it is that. And I think that a lot of the people in this community here are naturalist, I would say. They're very much into nature. They're here because of the nature. They love to go skiing in the wintertime or go walking, just take a walk across the land and or up and down our road here. I'd go bicycling. And when you have a farm that's thriving in a healthy way, it's such a nice thing to be able to bicycle past it or stop at it and get some vegetables or bread and or whatever they sell, to be a part of something so healthy and feels good, you know. So that,
like,
I think,
safe place.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, locally here, that's why people, that's where the move, that's what's driving the movement, you know, in those ways. And then in, like, the bigger scene, like all across the United States, it's like that, I'm sure, in a lot of communities. But I think a lot of it is that people's mindset is changing towards, they don't trust the big farms, or not just that, but also that they want to see a change. They're seeing that, like, the bigger something gets, the more it becomes, like, not, it's kind of like the idea that there's just 1% of, like, the money in our country runs everything.
Right.
So the bigger you get into any industry, you really have to question it, I think. Kind of the idea is that you want to start to, like, back away from that idea and look at who you're, you know, you want to look at who you're supporting, first of all, when you buy from the big place, and then realize, yeah, let's come down a lot, quite a few notches to supporting smaller businesses of all sorts and try to change the economy like that.
Yeah.
Because then you spread the wealth out over a big area instead of it just going through a few major avenues to the big guys and to the 1% of the money or whatever it is, you know, that's controlling it. And the government too, you know, which sometimes we're here like, you know, like, it's kind of nice to bring it down here to this level of local government and local, really small local government.
Yeah.
You know, and then create our own little world here, you know, instead of always just sending it out, like giving your money to somewhere else and it just disappears into who knows where, you know.
Do you think that almost by creating your own world here, you're creating a model for other communities? Like, what do you think the impact, do you care what the impact is on the rest of the country?
Yeah, totally. I think so. You know, we're a model here in this valley. This valley is known for being an educational place in a lot of different ways. And so people do come here to learn all different kinds of things. And it's just, you know, in the farming world, the North Fork Valley here, And like, if you say to somebody, "Oh yeah, we're in Paeonia Farming," and they're like, "Oh wow, what a great place! I always heard so much about the farms there, and that there's just so many organic, more organic orchards there than anywhere else in the state, and this and that, you know." And so people really know about it, and it is a model for a change. And I personally think that, yeah, I really do. I think that a lot, and a lot of the folks in this community, I really think that. A lot of us think that it's a great thing to hope that that goes out into the world and it helps to make change in other places where they're just beginning to decide to do that or open to the idea, you know, and that they may, you know, some of those folks from those communities come here and all of a sudden are more inspired to go home and do what we do here at home,
Yeah.
you know. So I think that's really important nowadays, to give people some other ideas, because I think some communities are really lacking, you know, and there's depression and all these issues in communities, and they need help, you know. And
Yeah.
so it'd be cool to see some of the communities where there's major drug issues or just there's no jobs, but they have land. You know, it's interesting, like, say, in Detroit, how there's this huge urban farm movement there. And in a lot of places, Philadelphia and stuff, on vacant land and lots. And you could imagine how depressed you could be if you're in Detroit or some city and you don't have a job. And you're challenged in so many different ways, maybe, and all of a sudden, somebody comes in and says, "Hey, let's have a farm here." And all of a sudden, and you know, maybe never thought about that in a million years, that that could be a possibility. And so all of a sudden, then you're working and living and on a farm or whatever, and you get to eat the food. And I think people appreciate food way more when they get to touch it and be a part of it's growing it. Like children, I've seen that on farms where they might not like vegetables at home on the kitchen table, but when you give them, you know, "Come out here to the farm and you want to help me with the pe picking the peas," well, they eat every one, you know. And at home they don't eat peas, you know. And so I think that's just the same for me, you know. I don't like vegetables from the store very much unless they're really fresh. And so when I'm out here working, I eat the vegetables all day long, you know, and then you feel really good. And so I think our model here, for other people to take it, is just really one of the best things you could ever do.
Totally. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. We focus a lot on mental health on the show in general. And I'm an angsty, kind of naturally depressy person. But see a huge impact when I'm like eating local wherever I am and eating lots of vegetables and stuff. And it's crazy what an impact it can do for people, especially when they're living. I've also lived in some big cities. Living in a big city, like in New York, the groceries is one of the big reasons why I left. Like, I'm tired of eating this shit that's like weeks old and gross and.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's like there's food deserts in places where you're just when you think about it, you're like, "Oh, that's whoa, what?" You know, it's hard for people to get food. In some places in the cities, I've heard people only have access to food through like Quick Marts and stuff, and stop like where the gas stations are. And I'm like, "Whoa, what?" You know, and it's kind of like there people are stuck. They don't have the money to get out of the city, you know, to get, you know, other opportunities. And so, you know, good food and actually working with the food, like producing it. I think people just, it's one of those things, it's like, it's in us, you know, it's like in our genes that to be able to be a part of the soil and plant a seed. And then, of course, the miracle of that always is like, what? How does that do that? You know, it grows up and then it gets bigger and bigger. And before you know it, you have tomatoes. And for people to see that and be a part of it, they might have heard about it, but some people have never been a part of that. You know, and I think it's a big missing link. And I think that's why, you know, too, for schools, for kids, in all ages, you know, for them to have an opportunity at the school or to be able to come to a farm and be a part of it at as early as age, early as of an age as possible is so important too, you know.
Totally, yeah. Again, I feel like that's something that I kind of missed out on.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in our country miss out on that. Like more, it's a very high number, you know. So it's sad.
So how long have you been farming?
You know, I started doing the vegetable thing in 1997, and not consecutively every year since then, but taking a few years off here and there because of children being born, and then having other work like doing carpentry work, and but always still having my foot in the farming, whether it was on a homestead where we lived at a homestead and then didn't really farm the land, but still like grew some of our own food, and or went to another farm and work traded for a little bit. You know, it wasn't like I was really farming, but just had my you know, my foot still in it. But since 97, that's when I first got into the organic farm production. And then when I was growing up, my parents, we lived in the country in Pennsylvania, and my grandfather had 20 acres of land, and he farmed it earlier on in his life. And then he quit doing that and did other things. And then my mom and dad homesteaded some of that land when I was a kid, baby, growing up until I was 10 or so. So we grew a lot of our own food. My dad raised rabbits. We lived on rabbits and all the vegetables we could grow. But then after, when I was about 10, my dad started doing other work, and our life changed drastically, like to where we didn't even have a garden. And like when I was like 13 or something,
yeah.
You know, he was too busy doing his job of being like more of a construction person, you know? Yeah. And I ended up going into that same field and being as a carpenter and stuff in my teen years, working for my dad because he had his own business. And then I went to college to be an architect. But then when I was in college, I realized that something's missing. I didn't feel that good about, like, I just didn't really enjoy it so much. I was like, there's something missing. So I actually quit school after 2 years of going to school and moved back to where the area I was from. And right away I was like, found work on a farm. And ever since then, I've been working on farms since I was 20, I guess I was 23. But the first farm, it wasn't a vegetable farm. I was taking care of horses and cattle.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And maintaining this farm, it was like a 100-acre farm. So I did all like the mowing of the land and every day in and out, like taking care of horses and the cattle.
Yeah.
And I just fell in love with it more and more. It got me back into feeling more like just who I really was. I like having my hands in the earth, you know, being around animals. I also had a big garden there. So I started growing my own food again. And I started baking my own bread. I just was like this, okay, I'm kind of going back to the lander here, you know?
Yeah.
And then I moved out to the Pacific Northwest, and my first job out there was on an organic vegetable farm. And I'd never worked on a serious production farm, vegetable farm. And I fell in love with it the first day I started working on it. I was like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for.
Right. Yeah.
I was 27, you know, so it took me a while.
The farm, I live in Portland, sort of. And the farms out there are incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. Produce for me.
Mm-hmm. I enjoy the Northwest. You know, it's fun. Like the Maritime, I really liked being on the near the water and stuff. But even though it rains a lot in the wintertime, I still enjoyed it so much, you know.
Yeah, that's my dream. So it sounds like you've had a pretty positive relationship with technology.
Yeah, I mean, I have a computer and I use it every day. Mm-hmm. I like go online every day to research. I mean, I use the Google all the time for like, oh, I have a question about what is this bug? You know,
yeah.
Why is this plant doing this? And usually you can find it online, you know, and I use it for my entertainment, watch Netflix and stuff. But at the same time though, like I will take breaks from it, you know, and of course I use it for communication through like emails, like lots of emails even every single day. And I use it also to stay in contact with our customers. I use a MailChimp thing, you know, and I send out weekly emails saying, here's what we have, what our market hours are, some pictures of what's going on the farm, like a little newsletter thing and stuff. So I use it for all those things, and I find it so valuable that I don't know if I could do without it. I sometimes threaten to sit and I say, oh, maybe in 2 years my goal will be to get rid of being offline, you know, on the farm. But I don't know if that's realistic or not.
It'd be tough.
Yeah, because I really do. Like lately I've been doing this research on a lot of different stuff, of course. It's like vegetable related, mostly farm related, and just a bunch of different areas. And then also to like look at new tools that I need and stuff. And it's like, how would I do that? You know, like, how would I source these tools? And like, I've been inspired by going online to YouTube and seeing other farms and what they're doing, and just any other, like in New Zealand or New York or wherever. And there's so many out there, and they're so willing to share. I mean, they have like, oh, subscribe, you know, because each week they're sending out another little 5-minute video about, here's what our tomatoes are doing this week on the farm. And some of these farms are so amazing in their production. Mm. And they're so small too, and they like do so well. And I'm like, wow, that's what I want to do, is even get smaller and still make it the same, you know, make the money we need.
Yeah.
And just be more comfortable with what I'm doing, not overwork, and just feel really good about it, you know. And so the technology is really important.
How much are you working?
Well, this summer we've not worked nearly as much because we didn't have the water. We cut back to like working a third of what we normally work, I bet. And so in a busy year though, we work, it's almost like every single day basically, but some days you're not working anywhere near as much. Like we try to take Mondays off a little bit because our busy weekend market is Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Mm. And then so Sundays don't really make sense to take the day off because we have a market. So Monday then is like a try to take that day off as much of it as possible. Generally though, because there's always something going on, like moving water, you know, like when you, in a good year, when you have a lot of irrigation water, you really need to be using it because so many things are thirsty in this climate. It's such a dry climate. So you can't just basically say, oh, we're going to shut off all the water today. Yeah. You know, so somebody's got to move that water. You know, you can't overwater plants. It's worse than underwatering just about. And or you could destroy your soils like by washing them out if you're not careful with checking on irrigation somewhere, because you never know, it could break. And then all of a sudden you have a high pressure water line that's eroding the soil somewhere. And, you know, so it's just almost like never a full day off. But again, that's part of my goal of tuning the farm so that there will be somebody else here scheduled mm-hmm. to do that. And then it wouldn't be myself, you know.
Yeah.
And then you have the full day off. But, you know, you have to start to manage and schedule and work with other people to the point of where that's a whole nother commitment to make that happen. So lately it's just been myself and my partner, Faith. We've been doing all the work the last 4 years and having a little bit of help come on. But we, at the same time, we really accepted that and said, okay, let's see if we can do it ourselves. And then just scale down a little bit too. Because we were a little too busy for a while. We were like kind of working and trying to produce too much, and then it wasn't as good either. So we said, okay, let's bring it down some. Let's just focus on our market here and see if we can do this ourselves. And it was really good because we could see then that if you're here without other people working, you can really focus on things better, and then therefore work out systems. And when you get the systems in place, then bring the people on. Mm. And so I think we're there. We're getting to that place where next year, as long as we have water. If we don't have water, we can't really bring people on. But if we have the water, then bring the people on to work here, whether it's even just work exchange trade kind of a thing for food, you know. And so schedule them to work certain days, and then we both take time off, you know.
Yeah. I think that's great advice for any entrepreneur or small business owners. You kind of have to like get your hands dirty and figure out the systems before you can hand it off.
Yeah, because when I first started doing this, I did have a lot of people showing up and helping, and I was running like kind of like where, you know, oh, you, hi, who are you? Oh, okay, you want to help out? Fine. You know, yeah. So I had a lot of people, and I get spread really thin on trying to bring that all together. And then again, I like to talk and learn, teach and show people what I've been doing. And then I get caught up in this, like taking the time to teach it. And then all of a sudden the day's over and we didn't get done what we were supposed to do. And I'm exhausted from like just talking about it all day, you know,
right. Yeah.
Instead of actually saying, okay, let's just get it done too, you know? And so I was just really just kind of, it was fun, you know, it was like, we just kind of, let's work here, and we did okay, but I didn't have the systems in place. And so, you know, sometimes I'd say to somebody, okay, just do that over there. Here's how I do it now. But if you have a better way, let's look at your way and try to do it. And then, and on doing, you know, and it just, we'd kind of get lost in it. And also just, yeah, it just took too much time and the conversations around what we're supposed to be going to do and stuff, instead of just having a cut and drag, like, here's how we do it. Watch me, and then do it exactly like this, you know.
Yeah.
And then now we have that way dialed in.
And maybe so. You could have like a meeting where it's like, if you have any ideas of how to better do this, this is the time and place for that.
Exactly.
Not like an official meeting, but yeah.
But yeah, except, it's a really good thing to sit down and then be like, okay, let's go over these ideas that we could change if you have a better way, you know, and then trial it, sample it, whatever, and see if it works. And then just managing all that. And I guess too, for a while, I got tired of trying to manage. Like I it's not that I can't do it, but I don't really like managing a business that much. It's not like my favorite thing. I like doing the farm thing, but I'd almost rather work for somebody else, to be honest with you. On a farm. Sometimes I think, oh, wouldn't it be cool to go work for another farm that's extremely successful, and just, you just go there and work, and then you don't have to be the one who's bringing it all together and being like, oh yeah, I got to order all these things because we're almost out of paper bags or whatever for packaging, or this particular thing, all taxes and payroll and this and that, you know, and that kind of thing. It kind of scares me away from, I don't want to do that in some ways because it takes you away from what you really want to do, like on the land, you know, like, because then when you become a manager, you don't always get to be out there putting your hands in the earth because you're just managing and you're like behind the computer more.
Right.
And that's what happens with a lot of businesses, you know, as you get more successful, you have people working for you, and then before you know it, you're in the office all the time, and you forgot what it was you're even doing. Right. You used to be the one that got to go out there and enjoy that, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not really ready to retire into the office at this point. I like being out in the field, you know?
That's your favorite part?
Yeah, yeah. And my favorite part of farming is actually growing the produce. I don't even like marketing it as much. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm okay with doing that and stuff, but I really like, in harvesting, I'd rather have other people harvest. I like planting it, figuring out the fertility of the soil, like cover crops and managing that, and planting and cultivating, keeping the plants ahead of the weeds, and, you know, figuring out systems that are more sustainable than what I'd had been doing or what is common, figuring out the tools. I even like to make some of the tools, or, you know, things like that. In the future, if we could keep this place successful and productive, then I think the people that we bring on will be doing the things like harvesting and post-harvest prep, meaning like washing it up and bagging it and then marketing it. But I'd like to be the one that does more like the figuring, the starting the seeds and then transplanting them and cultivating them and watering them and bringing them up to where they're harvestable.
You know, like the science.
I like soil science. It's a really fun study.
Let's talk about the drought and what the impact. You've mentioned, you know, you guys worked less. What was the bigger impact?
We haven't produced as much food recently, especially. Earlier on, we had water. And then our, you know, water source has gone out to almost none. And so we had to stop planting a while back. And then what happens is, stuff you planted early, you have that to harvest from for so long before it finishes out. Like, certain plants only produce for so long, and then you have to replant them. Mm-hmm. And so we do succession sowings, we call it, succession plantings of things all summer long in a normal year. We'll just keep planting, like, today, for in fact, maybe we would have cucumbers out here to be putting into a tunnel in order to have cucumbers clear until when it freezes. But we only did one planting of cucumbers a long time ago. And our cucumbers now, they're still producing, but they only produce really well for so long. And so, you know, we're really just slowly going down in our production. At first, for a while, it seemed great. It was like normal. But then because we didn't do those succession plantings of things, say, for example, two carrots, beets, turnips, things like that. You plant those early on in the spring, and then they mature and you harvest them. But you harvest them and you pull them out of the ground. It's not like you can just keep picking off of them. You pull the carrot out, it's done, you know. But you have to keep planting them every few weeks to a month or whatever. But when you don't have the water, you can't do that. And then all of a sudden have these gaps in your market. Like, there's no longer any more carrots. There's no more beets because you weren't able to plant them 50 days ago,
right,
which is how long it takes a beet to be ready to be picked, pretty much, is 50, 60 days. And the same with some carrots and things. So we're starting to really feel that now. We still have some produce, but it's been challenging because then financially you're challenged because you obviously don't have income from, you can't sell virtual produce.
Right. How do you work around that? Like, that has to be stressful.
Yeah, it is. However, we've been doing this long enough that we have some savings. And so that's the part of the resilience economic, you know, your economic resilience is that, okay, you don't have to make that money if you have some to live on and pay the bills. Right. So that's key. If you were just starting out in farming and you had no money to your name and you had a drought your first year, you may not be farming next year because you'd be out of business, possibly bankrupt or something, you know, especially if you invested a lot of money into that business the first year and then you didn't have the water you needed. And so all that money and time and energy you put into those plants, because you start plants March, February for your summer production, you know. So you can invest a lot of money into all that. In greenhouses, maybe they're heated even, you know, so you have a propane bill, or you just built the greenhouse and that, say, is $10,000 or something, or maybe you bought some equipment that costs money and you set things up, but then all of a sudden, and you have a debt, and so you need to pay that debt back, but you don't have any produce. So that would be a bad situation, and you may go bankrupt. However, we've been doing this for a while, long enough now that we have some money saved from it. We still are generating some income each week as well. It's not completely gone. And we're even still making enough money to be sustainable in paying our bills even at this point. It's just not that it's not like...
extra.
Yeah, you're not making extra for next year in case you have a drought for next year, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know? So that's something that we consider, too, is that if you had droughts back to back, then you could really have a hard time. You might have to go find other work, you know, stuff like that.
Is that a concern given?
Yeah, I think it is. Well, it's a concern for me because you don't know the weather, you know.
Yeah.
And so far, since I've been here for 10 years, 2012 there was a drought, but it wasn't as bad as this one. This drought is supposedly one of the worst since for 75 years, I've heard, you know, something. It's been, no one around here has seen something like this pretty much. And so, you know, we've been pretty happy, you know, we've had a good bit of snow over the last so many years, 10 years that I've been here, except for one winter or two winters or something. But we still were able to get through those without being, it wasn't too devastating. But this one's much bigger. And just with the kind of like way that there's like global weather changes and stuff, you know, it's called global warming. I call it global weirding too. And then this year I call it global burning because California's burning up. Colorado had so many fires.
Oregon's getting them right now.
Oh yeah, Oregon. I mean, people are dying in these fires, you know. And lately here for the last month, the smoke's been so thick, you know, that I've never seen it like this before.
Yeah.
And it's scary, you know, and you're just like, well, what's in the cards for the future? You know, it's like, because the weather patterns are chaotic and it's changing so rapidly that there's no guarantee you're going to have snow this winter. And Colorado needs snow for skiing, for that economic driver, you know, it's huge, for the farms, for your drinking water, for everything. And if you don't have that snow again, then what's this community do? You know, like, what if we don't have drinking water even?
Yeah.
You know, what if we're compromised with our springs for drinking? What if the ditches don't run even as long as they did this year? What if, you know, the community people start moving away because of water issues? And then, you know, or just are kind of feeling oppressed or suppressed or whatever somehow, you know, because it's just so hot and dry, and you get demoralized around that, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt this year on the farm, demoralized at times. I felt like it was so hot and dry and just wasn't raining when it was supposed to, you know.
Right.
And the joke here is that, you know, you never really know the weather here, you know. There's a saying, something like, if you think you know the weather here, then you're not from around here, or there's something wrong with you or something, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you never know, you know. It changes rapidly. It is a very arid region to begin with. So when we have some good snow years, you know, you're like, wow, this is amazing. But there's a big chance that that's not always going to be the case. And you could have a huge change for so many years of potential drought. It's not something that, you know, I'd be optimistic and say, yeah, it's going to snow this year and push that and yeah, bring it on. But historically, I think, and for the thousands of years, this place has been, you know, dry, and it could get really dry.
I heard this, I've not fact checked this myself, but I heard a stat that this area is supposed to be like Tucson by 2050 or something like that.
Wow. It'd be interesting. Yeah. I mean, like, we'll see, I guess, if we all live that long here.
Yeah.
If we're all here.
Hopefully.
Yeah, another 32 years or so. It's like, eh. I'm getting old, though, already, so I don't know if I'll be around.
Do you feel like the community is small or on a larger scale is prepared for these? Like, what happens if all those situations you listed?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm not so sure, you know, like for water, for example, for drinking water, I don't know how prepared we are as far as our domestic water sources. I mean, the town is in charge of that for the most part. And I don't know, again, too, if the springs dry up, there's nothing you can do about that. You know, you'd have to pipe water in or truck it in. And the whole thing is, too, is that in the West here, it's all about water.
Yeah.
I mean, it always has been, too. I mean, it could be your main doctor dissertation could be on water of the West. Yeah. And you could be a water lawyer, you know, you could like go into business on water, something. It's all about water. And if we have not enough water, and then other communities don't have enough water, and Denver doesn't have enough water, and California doesn't have enough water, then guess what? There's like all out, like, we all need the water. And if there isn't water here, that is what has changed civilization, like where Native American people who've lived in these areas for thousands of years, they can track, you know, archaeologists can show you that they moved from certain areas because all of a sudden there was a drought. You just can't materialize water, you know? Yeah. I mean, and if you don't have water, you cannot live, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not going to grow your food. You might be able to start, you know, just go to the supermarket and keep living like that for a while. But what if all of a sudden you don't have enough water to drink?
Right.
To bathe, to do anything, for your industry, for your farm, for whatever you need. Everybody needs water, you know? And so I think if, you know, with the changing, the global weather changes, global warming, that anything's possible now for this area to have more drought, possibly. I mean, maybe it's the new norm, you know?
Yeah.
I really, 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 really think that we are going to get snow and it's going to change, because that's what I've seen in my little time here. We had a drought in 2012, but it came back. Maybe this is just one little, you know, drought, one year, and then boom, we're going to have a big winter, the biggest winter in 50 years or something. I'm hopeful there, you know, but again, if it doesn't, then I really seriously have to change my lifestyle, and I may not be able to continue to live here as a farmer or whatever. Again, what this community can do in other ways, like say, besides, like maybe we still have water, but to start to study conserving water in all the ways you can. More rain catchment, for example, more permaculture methods for retaining the water and growing healthier soils. It's well known that hard packed clay ground is not going to absorb rain when it's especially a monsoon rain, which is what we get here in the summertime. And some of those rains, like today, there's a threat of flash flooding, I even heard. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, you know, all of a sudden you get like a high rain rate, you know, you might get an hour of rain, you know, a couple inches of rain in a big storm or something. Well, soil that has health to it, or tilth we call it, is the kind of soil that's like spongy when you walk on it and stuff. The water will go into that more likely than hard packed clay, which is like kind of like concrete. Yeah. So in farming, I've seen it even here in times when I have not always had the best practice in what I do. I see, oh yeah, look at my soils. They're getting packed and they're clay. They don't have enough organic material in them. They don't have enough plant life in them because we've tilled too much or whatever. And therefore then when you have a flash flood, it washes the soil away. It doesn't absorb the moisture and you're not getting anything from that rain, except it's water, it's running off your land, you know, you're not retaining it. So with all these good practices of, you know, studying ways of catching water in ponds and things, there's a better possibility of succeeding in a drought year.
Yeah.
You know, but again, that takes years to develop land, your farm and your yard, and even in town or wherever you are. It doesn't have to be a farm. You have to develop that over time, because the trees need time to grow that you plant to help. Also, trees help to, you know, stop the flow of water from coming down too fast, and they absorb it through their leaves some and dissipate it. So, you know, like there was a big forest fire in Colorado and near Durango. Well, now, because that whole canopy is burned and the earth is scorched and there's no more place for the water to be absorbed in to that biomass, that life form that was there, it all runs off and it floods to the point of where it's very dangerous. It can kill people.
Yeah.
You know, so they have warnings then, you know, like, look out, this is like, get out, you know, you have to evacuate. Because so that's what you deal with then whenever it rains hard. Whereas if it's naturally healthy and that rain can be absorbed and slowed down and you know, really absorbed into the soils and feed the plants and such, then you don't have that erosion problem, that flooding, and then things can succeed even in a drought year, you know, because right. When they get a little bit of rain, they can still use it.
Right.
Uh-huh. You know, and so those are all the things that this community, well, a lot of people are have been working towards that because they know that that's the climate here, you know.
Right.
Is that it's always a possibility for drought here and then flash flooding and whenever, you know, in the summertime and stuff, so.
Just have to prepare for it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas on what consumers can do their part in water conservation beyond, like, take fewer and shorter showers and how you wash your dishes, stuff like that? Do you have any other thoughts on that?
Well, I guess that for me, when I see, like, when I go through town or any places out here even, and I see a yard that's not being utilized for growing their own food, and they're maybe just mowing it all the time, you know, watering it, and all they do is mow it and stuff. And for me, it's always like, oh, I wish they were growing, like, everything there and had some goats and chickens and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I really don't know the answer to what you just asked, except, again, yeah, conserve the water and utilize, you know, just however you can conserve your water so that everybody has some water. But I think bigger than that is even, like, how everybody can even produce more in those kind of like with those permaculture methods on any size scale, even if you have like the tiniest lot in town, and so that your water then maybe from your sink can go out there and water the plants. And when you take a shower, maybe the water just doesn't go into the sewer, but rather it goes into a tank where then you can use it to water the plants. Develop systems like that, you know, and take it to the next step instead of it just going down the drain. I mean, again, if it just goes down the drain, at least it is going to go back into the river somewhere, into the water, you know, system. But to keep it longer here after you use it and slow it down again, because when it goes down the drain, it's just going to leave the area. But if you could actually grow some of your food with it in your backyard, and then what you're doing too is you're building the soils. You're doing something that is, again, you're not maybe running a lawnmower all the time, which a gasoline lawnmower is going to be partly why we have global warming, you know, because it's burning fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of why we have such an imbalance, you know, so much CO2 in the air and stuff, and why we do see so much change, you know, and like this giant change on the earth right now. And it's very exponential too. But again, like, yeah, using that water, keeping it on your land as long as possible to get the most out of it and create really nice habitat. Because I think then if you have an area where everybody, you know, in an area where more and more and more people are doing that, it's just going to be more and more lush, beautiful place, and build morale in a drought year.
Yeah.
And people will be more self-sufficient, and they won't be used spending their dollars outside the community as much. Because
mm-hmm.
most people then, if you don't grow much of your own food and you just have big yards that you got to maintain, and you're still trying to water those yards especially too, where do you get your food? You got to buy it, and generally you're going to go to the grocery store and the food's going to come from somewhere else, you know, and all your food dollars. Like even in this county, I think it's said something like that it's like $70 million a year, or even maybe just in this part of the valley, I forget. It's a lot of money that is spent outside. It's just the food dollars go like $70 million or something. Is gone to California. A lot of food's coming from there, and just for people to get more conscious about, yeah, let's grow our own food and develop systems that work for all our gray water or whatever, you know, or that kind of thing, instead of it just going into the sewer or just into a septic tank or something, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a big topic that we definitely don't have to dive like super into, but any thoughts you'd want to share on the whole coal, natural gas, fracking, solar situation here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say it's a really scary thing to live in the shadow of where there are large companies that want to come in here and frack the area. It's really scary. That's like a big, you know, threat to the area because it easily could contaminate our water.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, yeah, we have very little water, and yet imagine having, you know, fracking fluids accidentally dumped or, you know, a wreck on the highway into the reservoir that's above our town, right?
Right.
And so it's just hanging there above you. And so that threat. And so you can't completely focus on what you really want to do in life, which is farm or do your business and enjoy your life and play with your kids or whatever it is. You have to like constantly be working to keep that away, you know, or help to regulate it, because it doesn't seem to want to regulate in a really wise way on its own, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm in a place where it's a very, really nice move to not burn as much fossil fuel on the planet, because I totally get how that works.
Yeah.
That fossil fuel is laid down for millions of years and we burn it up in seconds, basically.
Right.
And then the imbalance problems begin, you know, and have begun and are really noticeable now. And so I'm all for the change to solar power and to not just use alternative energy sources, but to cut back on how much energy we use. And that's a big thing for me, has always been, yeah, I don't think the answer is to only use solar panels and to, you know, use whatever alternative method there is, because some of that stuff, you know, all of it's way far better than burning coal for power and drilling for more gas for power or for whatever you need it for. But again, you know, like, what if we first cut back some and then use solar,
yeah,
or wind?
Because that's also still an industry that at the mm-hmm. end of the day,
yeah,
needs to make money, and
yeah,
that's
yeah,
going to drive its decisions.
Yeah, and it's technology. And again, with technology, if it's not regulated and stuff, there's a side of the pollution on the sides of that, you know, like that comes from it. We still have to truck it all, you know, I mean, and again, I'm like all for it. I mean, I have some solar panels and stuff here, and it's just the neatest thing. And it's like way better substitute for you getting your electricity than a coal burning generation station. And since we have coal mines right up the road here, and you see the train and hear the train haul, you know, millions of tons of coal out of this valley, and then
they haul a hundred
cars at each load, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, I forgot. I mean, each of those cars has probably 100 tons on it.
Yeah.
But they've been doing that for many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
Till time, it's like people, you know, it goes back, you know, forever that they've been hauling that coal out of here. And it's just like, wow, all that coal goes, and guess what? It's burnt up to make power and stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And then it's like, okay, we need to come back and get more coal. And it's just, and then the infrastructure just to move the coal and then to burn it. And
right.
then just to get that power for an instance, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm one of those kind of people that first says, let's cut back on our energy usage. And then for sure, yeah, when you need the power, let's put in the solar. You know, in this climate, it's perfect for solar, of course. It's like we've got 300 days of sunshine, if not more, here. And it's just ready and waiting, you know, solar hot water or solar electric, both. We made our own solar hot water heater here, and so we take our showers every day when the sun's shining, and it's too hot. You have to, like, mix it with cold water. It's too hot all
really?
The time. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's just like, wow, instantaneously, as soon as the sun hits it, it's so hot, you know.
Wow.
And you're always like, wow, that's amazing. This is like almost boiling hot water, and it's just from the sun.
Yeah.
And you, when you drive around the area, you don't see very many hot water solar panels on roofs, and you think, wow, most people are heating their water with gas or electricity.
And there's
still
so much sun here.
Yeah. And there hasn't, you know, really, the government doesn't push with our new political, you know, change in Washington. It's a fight in the other direction now. Instead, it had been where everybody was starting to do more and more and more solar and everything. But now things have changed in the last couple of years. It's like, now it's like they're fighting it the other way. You know what I mean? So like, instead of their incentives to put solar up, there's incentives not to, to like burn coal. Let's burn more coal. You know, we're like, man, really? You know, so it's depressing.
Yeah, I go on a political rant in every episode, so I'm gonna resist. But
yeah,
it's insane. It's yeah, literally insane.
Yeah,
it's,
especially yeah, when you're here and you like, you know, it's like the only way, right? Because it's so much sun.
Yeah, dude, I, you know, will like go for a short walk. I like take a lot of walking breaks. I haven't been great about putting sunscreen on. I see sun on my mm-hmm. like, it's strong here.
Yeah, yeah,
strong.
Yeah, it's strong. Yeah, we're 6,000 feet
yeah,
right here, you know, so it doesn't take much to get cooked by the sun. But yeah, it's like the energy thing is such a big thing for us here, because it is like the fracking's really, they're doing it in our backyard and wanting to do a lot of it, and consistently, you know, constantly you have to be on guard to like, oh, there's, you know, there's this new thing that they're trying to pass so that there'll be more, less regulations, and that now that the government, they won't even be asking us if we think it's a good or bad idea, you're like, oh no, you know, like, yeah, they're trying to take the democracy away of the decision making, you know, so then you have to fight that, you know, you're like, every single day there's another memo about, oh, sign this petition because now they're trying to do this, you know, or a meeting to go to the, because now they want to do this, and it's just so close to home now here, and it's so scary, you know.
I think, like, to your point, I'm feeling everywhere I go a collective exhaustion. People are energized because they're pissed, mm-hmm, but they're also starting to get tired because, mm-hmm, it's so much fighting.
Yep, totally. Yeah, and money. You know, you have to raise money in order to fight this stuff, you know, lawyers and whatnot you need. And just to write, you know, for the whole, or any organization to operate, it needs money. So you have to generate money, you know, get the money and raise the money and stuff. And so that's another part of it, you know. It's not only people are getting, you know, overworked in those, you know, trying to fight this stuff, but then they're like, oh, we need more money. So, you know, hopefully we'll be able to ban fracking.
Yeah.
Worldwide. Hopefully soon. And then that'll go away. But I guess there's a lot of people wanting that, you know. It's just like a different, what it is, I think, you know, too. It's just like there's so many people still like that. That's their career. That's their life. That's all they know. They believe in it wholeheartedly. You know, it's a slow change for that because I get it too. You know, like if you're in their shoes and you don't really know and think of anything outside of what that world is, then of course it's what you fight for. Oh, it's how I make my money. You know, I work in that industry. You know, and so for things to change, though, for those people to have different opportunities to work in the solar industry, for them to be able to open their minds and be educated on, like, oh, there's this other way, you know, and that's been going on. Like, we have Solar Energy International here, which is just down the road here, and it's been really neat to hear what some of the stuff they've been working on, where the government has even been able to help people that were, like, in the coal mines that have lost their jobs, possibly to get the education they need to be a solar installer, you know, to start maybe their own business or work for somebody else and make decent money.
Yeah.
So that now they can be like, instead of working in the coal industry, I'm working in the solar industry. You know, or people that are coming back from wars in our military to have an opportunity to have a job in the solar industry. You know, and it's like, wow, there's some cool stuff going on there. You know, so there's a change, you know, but still a really, really, really big world of people that believe that it's still just, we need to burn up the coal, you know. It's like so much money in that.
Yeah.
You know, and they're making a good salary on it, and that's what they do, you know.
Yeah, we toured the West Elk.
Oh. Did you go underneath, too?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was nuts.
I don't know if I want to go down there.
That's cool, though. I suggested. It's like a pretty surreal, not pretty surreal, it's a very surreal experience.
How deep did they take you down in?
1,000 feet.
Wow.
7 miles in, 1,000 feet down.
I would not want to do it. I just don't like that idea.
The truck drive was a lot. I was in, like, the back closed-in thing.
7 miles?
Just in, and then 1,000 down.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1,000 feet down. Yeah.
Man.
Just staring at these walls that are 65 million, billion?
I bet you 65 million, at least. Yeah, 65 million, yeah.
Do you have any opinions on, like, the history of the coal here? And, like, because people talk about the heritage, right?
Right, yeah, and I don't want to, I don't think we need to, like, you know, you don't want to, like, take away somebody's, what they're proud of and their families, generation after, you know, many generations of people have been here working in those mines. You know, oftentimes back, especially back in the day, right, you know, your dad was a miner, you got a job as a miner, your kid got a job, you know, and the people are proud about what they do. I understand that's a good thing, you know, to be somebody who's excited about what you do and proud. I just think that we're at a place now where it's the change, it's ready for change, because if you really look into it and see, it's, you don't even have to be necessarily a scientist or a chemist or a physicist or anything like that to understand that when you burn so much mass that took millions of years to create, basically, or to form, and you burn it really fast, because the way we live on the earth right now is pretty fast, you know, and every day we're burning more fossil fuels than we've probably ever burned, right? And that change in the chemistry from a solid fuel that's right here, which we call carbon, sequestered carbon, you know, that's in the form like this. It's not a gaseous form. When you burn that and it goes into its different parts, and part of it goes off as CO2 and other gases and things. And then what that does to our air, if we're at 400 parts per million of CO2 or whatever it is right now, it's so much more than what it was just a decade ago.
Yeah.
And that is changing so fast. Like if you go into a major city and there's just all these gasoline burning and diesel trucks, and you try to like live in that environment,
yeah,
how do you feel, you know? And yeah, it smells, right? And it's like, you know, that, you know, it's just like we're converting, you know, it's like we have to start to say, wow, we are changing things too fast.
Yeah.
We have, you know, no matter how much we've invested in it or where we come from in that and how proud we are of something, at some point we have to like say, this is true. Or it is what it is, and do you want to keep doing this so that the next generations have very low quality of life? And also, I'm the kind of person, too, that's not about, like, burn it up, do it up, make a lot of money, don't worry about the future. And I think that that's our government right now, federal, you know, our bigger government. Not everybody in the government, obviously, but the people trying to run the government.
This has been happening in industry forever.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, think about logging.
Yeah,
and
it's because then that's the dollar, right? I mean, that's right. How you generate the dollar. You use things up. Yeah. It's a very much to exploit.
Yeah.
Use is even like, yeah, you use it. It doesn't sound like a nice thing, right? Instead of like working with something, let's figure out how we can survive on this planet with the least amount of impact. Maybe is a good way to say it, you know, yeah, stuff like that. Instead of, let's just make a ton of money right now and not worry about anything.
Right.
And that's why I farm. Yeah. I mean, I don't make a lot of money. I don't even really try to make a lot of money in farming. Yeah. Some farmers make a lot of money, and believe it or not, and I'm not one of them. And I actually try to stay on the low side of it because I don't want to play that game, really, mm-hmm, like the big money game thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I would rather make enough money and subsist, be almost a subsistence farmer, like homestead, where like that's kind of like my model almost is like I'm more of a hybrid farm / homesteader, mm, you know, whereas like I don't need as much money then if I can kind of live off the land too. And right, I just enjoy that style and speed of life, you know.
When you're homesteading, do you feel like there's still enough going into the local economy? I guess just purely by taxes and shit, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I still have to pay taxes and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I, like, still, like, spend a lot of money in the town and everything and pay for, you know, all the... and when we sell produce here, we actually generate enough to pay all the local, you know, our sales taxes. We actually have a certain amount. We don't pay a state because we're exempt because it's food. But we pay a county tax. We don't pay a city tax because we're out of the city, but we still have to pay a county tax. And they fixed our road here one year, a while back, and I was like, yay, we love paying our taxes because you fixed the road. You know,
yeah,
you know, even though I was like, I don't really like the road being fixed because it's too big now, but you know, I'm just like, God, let's stay like kind of like out here in the country roots here. But I'm just not somebody who says let's burn it up, let's get really aggressive and not to exploit the earth. It's rather like be gentle on it, more of like a Native American attitude, where what I've heard with people who've studied their cultures is that they didn't have a word for progress. And I'm not against progress. I think progress can be good if it's good, you know, in the way of like saving people's lives and stuff. And, you know, when your kid's sick.
Better ways of farming.
Where in better ways of farming, where you use less resources or less fossil fuel. So progress technology, like a friend of mine works in the electromotive sector, kind of, I guess you'd call it. And he specifically works with e-bikes, and he's long-term loaned us 2 e-bikes to utilize for like the last 4 years. And I drive my car so little here. Once a week, we use the car a little bit, especially because we're hauling a bunch of stuff. Absolutely don't even have to use it on that one day, but we do use it, you know, some. But almost all of our trips, and we'll go to town every day. Oh, I need this. I need that. I need to go see somebody, whatever. It's all done on the e-bike.
Yeah.
And it uses like 1% of what the car energy would be using, you know. And it feels good too, because it's empowering in the way of like, yeah, I get to go on a bike ride, and yet I'm not working too hard on the bike, you know, because it's assisted with a battery, you know, that lasts a very long time and so forth. And it can be charged with solar energy and just all those kind of things. And it's just a really great system. And so back to that's progress in a way, the technology, where it's freeing us from using a car that's more destructive, you know, and more polluting. It's not even just more polluting and using more fuel, but I noticed that when I used to do deliveries for produce, of produce, and I would use my car when I first started. And I'd go into town and I'd have to like park in town, downtown, you know, and you're finding a parking spot. And then my friend, he's like, okay, you want to use this bike, this e-bike. And he had a trailer for me to use. And so I started doing deliveries with the trailer. Well, when you go into town with a bicycle and trailer, first of all, you're not in a car anymore driving around town. So there's one less car in town. That means there's like less chance for me to like be in a wreck, hurt somebody, a little kid. And the pollution, the noise, and it's more hectic when you're driving around, you know. And you're driving down and somebody backs up, you know, like, oh, you know, whatever. But without a bicycle, you know, you can kind of like go on the side streets and cut through here, and you don't have to find a parking spot the same. And so the deliveries became way more fun. Yeah, so back to the technology, the progress. I mean, there's a place for it. And is, I think that's the thing, you know, we just have to steer our progress, our technology advancements into the way, in the ways of where, be creative with it, where we are still able to do what we need to do. We might have to adjust how we do it. Like, oh yeah, I mean, I can't haul as much on the bike as I can in a car or a truck. But then you start to say, well, maybe I don't need to use the car and the truck to drive clear over there to deliver the produce. What if I like advertise in a different way, saying I'm using this bicycle and I'm going to do local deliveries, and would you like to sign up for my weekly email? And and I'll sell you vegetables. You can just order them online and I'll return. You know, that's how I did it. I would send out an email. People would say, oh, he's got carrots and turnips and beets and this and the price. And they'd say, okay, I'll take one of each of those, Scott. And then I would reply back, thanks. I'll be delivering on Friday after 3 o'clock from 3 to 6. And they loved it. And it helped me build the business too.
Yeah.
So it created a whole new kind of business model by doing it with the bike. And I think people are more likely to buy from you if you're doing something different. And especially if it's better thing than what you were doing, like get you out of it, no more car.
Right.
And a lot of people here are all about that, you know, they have electric cars, and a lot of people here have e-bikes, and a lot of people here are really saying, yeah, we need to get away from using so much energy and stuff, you know. Yeah. So it's cool how you can, like, start becoming creative with these new advancements that you may have never thought of before.
Why do you stop doing deliveries?
Well, because I actually got burnt out on it for a few reasons in that it started becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And then to manage that, I would have had to go to all these different computer programming systems in order to manage all that. Because what I was finding each week, I was on the computer a lot to try to create my pick list. So I would know how much to pick. And then to pick it all, get it all prepped, and then pack it all. And then the logistics of that is like, you know, it's like UPS or something or the postal service. You have to like get it figured out. Like when you pick it, pack it, invoice it, and then deliver it. And especially when it's hot too.
Yeah.
And you have a time frame you have to do it in. And it's after a whole big week of working. And you're like, oh man. And I enjoyed it for a while. But then as the business got bigger and bigger and bigger, I was like, I don't know, you know, I don't know if I really want to do this. And I also, at the same time, offered for people to come and pick up produce.
Yeah.
And they started to come and pick up, and they liked doing that so much that I just, for all those reasons, getting tired of it and getting bigger and realizing, well, if I'm going to continue to do this, I have to, like, up the game with, like, more systems, and I'll be, you know, again, like I was saying earlier, managing the farm isn't really what I want to do. I want to just work in the soil. So I started to see it getting complicated if I kept doing the deliveries. Neat and fun, and, you know, did a really great idea and really fun challenge, but yeah, maybe not. And so people started just to come here, and eventually the deliveries just, I was like, okay, we're not going to do that this year and try something different just to see. And then people would come to the farm, because that's the other thing. Back to your question about why are people buying, there's a movement to buy local food at small farms again. And part of it is because they do like to come to a farm to have that connection. Because their life is, you know, in a way completely opposite of a farm in a way. Like sometimes, you know, they don't get to touch dirt and they're in an office all day and the kids are at school all day and they come home and the house, it's just an apartment and there's no yard and they're whatever. And so they're like, oh, wouldn't it be cool to go to a farm? You know, you don't have to pay to come here. You don't even have to buy anything, you know, but you could walk up here and some farms have like animals all around. You could pet it, you know, have a petting zoo. We have a bakery down here. And so a lot of people come for the bread and the vegetables. And it's not like we like really, you know, offer a lot on our, when they come here, but they just like to come here, you know. And there's times when we do have like, where we show demonstrations of like how we do things and talk about stuff like that. And you could even do like certain days of when people are coming up here, you could do bigger farm tours if you want. We do certain we do so many farm tours a year, not like every week or anything. We've also, just because we have so many people come here, we aren't always available either, because it's just so much public that you're like, as a farmer, you're like, oh my God, I was out there for 4 hours talking to somebody. I didn't get anything else done today. And yeah. I have all this work, you know? So sometimes we kind of like hide out, you know, like yeah. getting our work done over here, because we know what'll happen if we're available, you know? Right. And our barn market actually runs on its own. It's an honor system market. Okay. So when you come up, you just get what you want and you pay.
Oh, cool.
And there's nobody running it. And yeah. that saves us from having to pay quite a lot of money per weekend for somebody to actually be in there watching it or taking money. So people just have to pay with exact money or check, and there's no credit cards or anything and stuff. So yeah, that's why we went away from that delivery service, you know, for all those reasons. And it's not that you never know, that might come back, you know. But I just saw the interest. People just love to come here, and I was like, wow, that's amazing. I'm just like, okay, well, it's easier for the farmer then.
Yeah.
You know, we still generate the same or more money and with less work.
Right. Okay.
So.
Yeah. So a few more questions. If I was to come here and was like, Scott, I want to move to Paonia and start a farm, mm-hmm. what would you say to me?
I'd say, you're welcome. Come on in. More power to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You wouldn't say like, there have been droughts.
Oh, well, well, I figure you'd probably do some research too.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, like I wouldn't want to deter your, you know, break your spirit down or anything. No, but, you know, as we would talk and further into the conversation, I would say, well, you do know that it's like, you know, it's not the easiest place to farm. Well, nowhere is easy to farm, really. Every place, you know, there's always looks greener over there until you get there and it's like it rains too much over there, right?
Right. Yeah.
Floods the valley over there or something. Or whatever. And but yeah, I mean, I would tell you that, yeah, it's a it's an awesome place to come and do that, and it may really work for you. But again, yeah, I mean, you never know with the weather and stuff at this point.
Yeah.
You know, but we do need more farms here.
Okay.
You know, it's not something where I'm like, oh, I'm jealous, or not jealous, but like
competitive.
Yeah, competitive in that way. I mean, competition drives what I call like excellence, you know, in the way of like, you know, if you have more restaurants in a town, everybody has to up the game and make more tasty, better food or whatever. So that's what's cool about that kind of competition. But I love having more and more people come here that really want to farm, because if you look out around, there's not just like farms everywhere. It's like you said, there are only so many handfuls of them in this whole valley. There's not hundreds of them, even, or thousands of them. You know, it'd be fun to have more and have that community grow where we do have more shared knowledge and whatever else we can share, you know, and maybe some tools or whatever, and just, yeah, resources. Maybe one farm has a certain awesome, oh yeah, I generate all this compost that I can't use at all because I have all these animals and I would like to sell it. Well, that's an awesome thing for a farm like me, because I don't generate enough compost for what I need. So I lately, for what I do, I've been having to research where I can get a really, you know, a good compost, or, you know, composted manure or other kinds of hay and whatnot, that's done in a way that can be used on a vegetable farm, that it's still safe and stuff, you know, and for use. And so it's not like, you know, biologically unsafe or whatever. And so the more farms, there's usually always a lot of cool things that they're doing that you can learn from, or you're doing that they want to learn from, and relationships. I mean, at my favorite community is always around the farming communities in any community. You know, you have your bigger community that you really love, and then in that are all the farmers, you know, and then they get together for certain events and things. We have this, it's called Valley Organic Growers Association. So it's an association of growers that meet so many times a year, and they have different programs for people to learn through. You know, if you're an intern, they have some great stuff going on for interns. And maybe possible to get grant money through them. They're very, really always figuring out how to help the farmer out. And when we get together at some of the potlucks, it's like just so fun. You know, everybody, the farmers bring all the really great food, you know, and you have cherry pies because they had cherry trees, and, you know, and the conversation is so fun because, you know, you're always like, oh, how's everything? How are you doing with growing peaches? Oh, you know, and it's just like that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
I love that. It's like old fashioned or something. It's so different. I don't know.
Yeah, totally. Do you eat meat?
I do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you and your family live on the property?
Yeah. And the meat I eat, though, is I source it from another farm.
Okay.
And it's grass-fed beef. And then we also get milk from another farm that's grass-fed. The animals, the cows are fed grass only or hay. And so we get milk from that person and butter from them. So once a week, go to their farm and get the milk. And the other farm, yeah, they just raise their animals out in the field, no confinement whatsoever. They only eat grass and hay. Living in this community, it's the best food, you know. And I don't know if that's the right word, but my body, how I feel when I eat that meat and that milk, I feel really good and strong, and I work a lot. And if I'm not careful, I like dwindle to nothing.
Yeah.
I can't maintain body mass if I don't like really. And I've gone away from eating, like when I was certain times in my life, I would just like snack on whatever, you know, like food that didn't have much food value,
right?
You know, which is a lot of like this stuff you get in the chips or something, maybe from somewhere, that are just whatever kind of chips, or, you know, some strange thing that you're not sure. Oh, I'm just hungry, and just put it in your mouth. You know, it's like driving down the road, and instead of eating a carrot, you're eating something from a store, and you're like, well, actually, what is this? And then you're like, oh, I don't know if I feel so great. But like the meat really works for me. It must be just my type or whatever. And I,
Are you an O blood type?
Probably, yeah. And it just like feels so good, you know, to like, I feel, and sometimes that's all I eat is just that and some vegetables. So it works for me. But at the same time, I still think about how, though, in the bigger picture of things, that maybe it's not the ideal thing. I'm not sure, you know.
So two questions I ask everyone. First is, what does the word process mean to you?
Process?
Mm-hmm.
The word process for me means to maybe change something, to develop, to bring it from, say, a piece of wood that you cut down in the forest and alter it, change it into something a little different, like carve it into a totem pole, for example. That process from when it started and what you had to do to it, and it was a step-by-step process, and then the finished product. That's what process means to me. It also, like when I first hear that word, I think of processed food.
Yeah.
You know,
it's change.
yeah but that's process. So it's a certain movement and change and altering to get something from this to that, whether it's a raw unfinished product to its finished state to where it's usable or whatever, you know.
It's funny you say that. I haven't really thought of like the negative connotation of the word process when I named the show.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, I should just delete that.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. What is something that you're excited about today?
I'm excited about that I got to go to another farm and find out that they have this ready-to-go, awesome compost that they don't need. Mm-hmm. And then I can purchase it from them. And it's going to help me with my fertility program here on the farm so that this winter I can grow way better vegetables.
Yeah.
And it's an organic source, healthy, good product that I don't have to try to source in a very other complicated ways, because it weighs a lot. It's like 2-ton containers of this stuff that another farm doesn't need. So I'm really excited about that, first of all. And that might seem like funny or weird, but I really am, because I'm excited. Well, and also I'm excited that it's raining. And, or it's going to rain more, I think, here. It's trying to. Yeah, and that we're working on our fertility plan for the winter time so we can grow things even in the winter in our tunnels.
Yeah, so that was something I meant to ask, is what you do in the winter. You're able to grow some stuff in there?
Yeah, we don't grow anywhere near as much in the winter time, but we can grow some stuff, and we basically have to start it now or in the next month or so. Some things we can start a little later, but we can't wait too long until it's like really extremely cold and stuff, or the stuff won't sprout and grow. But if we can get things to start to grow now, because it's like I direct seeded carrots the other day. Well, it rained just the other day, and it's looking like there's a big chance of rain in the future here, that those will germinate and start to grow, and then they'll eventually be ready like in December, January. So as long as I start them now, how I can have it then. Yeah. And same with salad greens, I have to start them now in order for them to be pickable, but we'll pick them the whole way through the winter, clear into April.
Oh, cool.
As long as we get them started, you know, sometime this fall, before it gets really cold. And then we can pick salad greens, we can harvest carrots, beets, turnips, as long as we start them early. I learned this last year, I can plant carrots in January in a tunnel. Mm-hmm. They're unheated tunnels. They're just a passive solar type system. If I plant them in January, then I'll have them ready in April and May. And so we can winter farm to a point, and it helps us with being more sustainable. Like, so now, you know, we're in this drought summer, not making as much money, but we can farm in the wintertime and make some money. Not as much as in the summer, but it helps us throughout the whole year because we're making a little bit more, you know, money in the wintertime.
Yeah.
To help balance, you know, the summer production, so...
Do you ever take a vacation?
I take small ones. Like in the last few years, I've taken lots of small ones. In 2014, I went away for 2 weeks to Germany.
Oh, wow.
In Austria, a friend of mine. Yeah.
You and your partner?
No, I went with a buddy of mine that had to go over there for some other stuff, and he was really familiar with that area. He goes over there a lot for business, and he was kind of like my guide. Because I didn't speak German or anything.
Yeah, I've spent some time in Germany. Too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And we were in Bavaria in the southern part, mm-hmm. and then in Austria, and a little bit in Italy, where Austria, Italy, and Switzerland all come together.
I hiked those Alps last year.
Yeah.
In August last year.
Oh, wow, yeah, because it's like one of my favorite places on the earth, the Alps.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. So we, you know, but that was back in 2014. And then, you know, this point in time, we just like take weekend here. We'll get some time off. But my partner and I don't even always get to go away at the same time.
Yeah.
So we just kind of, you take this weekend or these few days, and then I'll be here, and then I'll get to go away. So it's kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But that works sometimes, too. You need to just be on your own, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
That's good, you know. Yeah. So.
Cool. Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This was great.